And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. I'm your host, Mike Schultz. We talk about ancient mysteries and unsolved mysteries and non-corporate news of the day. So today we're going to talk about a mystery up in Canada. There is a treasure shaft that people have been trying to dig down under for 200 years, and they still have not found the treasure. So my guest is the author of a book called The Lost Treasure of the Knights Templar. His name is Stephen Sora. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here.
Okay, great. Why don't we start the story back in the year 1795. There's three teenagers walking along the beach looking for some treasure, and they find a little depression in one of the little tiny islands called Oak Island. Why don't you take it from there?
In 1795, we were just past the golden age of piracy, and Captain Kidd's treasure and others like Bluebeard were rumored to be everywhere along the Atlantic coast. And these three young men decided that that's what they were going to do. They went out to Oak Island, was an island just off the shore of where they lived. On the island, they found something hanging from a tree. They also found a depression underneath, and they thought this could be where someone might have buried something. So they started digging. About 3 feet down, they came across flagstones, which were not indigenous to the island. Removed those. About 10 feet down, they came across an oak platform. And this was really interesting and kind of showed that they were really onto something. They dug that up by themselves. They went down another 10 feet, another oaken platform. They went down to 30 feet and still a third platform. By this time, they had exhausted their abilities, and they tried to enlist the help of some of the local men, but Nova Scotia was a tough place to be. People made their living working hard in farming and fishing, and they didn't have time for fun and games like that. So it was pretty much forgotten for a while after that.
Right, and over the years, many different syndicates and companies have kind of joined forces, haven't they, to dig deeper and deeper?
That's right, and over the years, some illustrious money came into the picture. Errol Flynn invested, Franklin Delano Roosevelt invested with them, and one by one, all these different companies and syndicates made their own advances, but never really far enough. And it wasn't until in the last century that they, in the 19th century this is, that they came across a booby trap. They were down to past 90 feet. They found a stone down there that said 40 feet below a treasure will be found worth 2 million pounds. And so one morning, everybody took a look at the hole, all the men that were working there. They went to church, and when they came back, they found the whole hole was flooded in. And this started a long series of events trying to find out where the flood was coming from. Using red dye and dynamite, they figured out that first there was one tunnel coming from what they called Smith's Cove, and then later on, after kind of plugging that one up, they found out that there was still another one coming from somewhere else. They've never been able to turn off this booby trap, this flood of water that comes into the tunnel.
So obviously it's a very elaborate, complex trap that has stumped all the experts for hundreds of years. But before we get to where it actually came from, let's talk about the different layers. There's charcoal and blue putty and coconut fiber that's not really indigenous to this island, correct?
That's right, and it kind of, you know, it's just served to add up to some confusing guesses then as far as where things came from. The drains that actually protected the booby trap were coconut husk. So this would kind of, they would place these over the drains, and it kind of would make it clog-proof so they wouldn't just stop working on their own. They found down over 100 feet, they found puddled clay. They found iron boxes at, I think, 126 feet. They found a cement vault at 150 feet. And in drilling through those, which becomes harder and harder, all they really brought up was some parchment, some gold chain, and no treasure at all.
Was there anything that they could make out of these little bits and clues? I mean, would that have led them anywhere, or is it just random parchments and coins and things?
At this point, I think that it was just random things, and I think my own theory of what happens when you go down that far is that you just set the booby trap off, and it was basically then designed to stop anyone from digging further. The rock that they found, the inscribed stone that was found at 90 feet, indicated 40 feet below. I almost feel that that was a mistake, that was all the way down there, and they found it much later than when they originally started digging. I think it actually could be like a pirate bank, like has actually been found on St. Mary's Island in Madagascar, that there's an original shaft, and then there's tunnels that actually go upwards closer to the ground. And so it could just be that 40 feet below the actual surface of the island is where these treasure vaults really exist.
That's a really interesting theory. So let's talk about one of the beaches on Little Tiny Oak Island. It actually, there's a kind of a false beach. Why don't you describe how they found that and how that works?
Smith's Cove has actually been, someone had once upon a time actually stopped the water from coming up to the shore at that point. They erected these shafts that actually bring the water in from the drains. They planted those drains. Obviously, someone that was very adept at hydraulic engineering, and then they allowed the water to come back. And the excavators almost did the same thing. They built a cofferdam to stop the water. It took quite a long time. It was quite an effort for them to do that. And as soon as they were completed and they found these drains, what happened was a storm broke up their cofferdam, and so they were dealing with the same problem again. It's hard when you look at the beach there. Smith's Cove actually looks like one of the few beaches, actually, that is actually on the island. Most of it is just oak trees, trees that go to the shoreline, very few oaks anymore.
I see. So let's talk about the possible suspects of who would have gone to so much trouble and engineering and all these hundreds of people to create this complex trap. Let's talk about maybe pirates or Vikings or Sir Francis Drake. Who are the suspects here?
When I started working on this, the Vikings was one theory, except the Vikings that came over, and I actually visited like where they landed in Newfoundland, they were just too poor to have any treasure that would be worthwhile in burying. Their ability developing some kind of hydraulic contraption that, you know, would make that booby trap was unlikely. So I kind of crossed them off the list. Another really interesting theory that it might have been Spanish miners, and they were coming back with a Spanish treasure ship. It might have got weakened in a storm off Florida. One ship alone then lands at Nova Scotia. They decide that they're not going to make it home with all that gold and silver in the hold. And so because these people are engineers, and mining was actually a lot further along 500 years ago than we believe today. And so maybe they created that trap, attempted to sail home, and the ship was lost. So that's one that I kept on the table as something that could really have happened. When I met David Tobias back in 1980, he owned half of Oak Island at that point, and he just recently sold his half out. But his consideration was Sir Francis Drake. Sir Francis Drake was a pirate that legendary as far as attacking the Spanish Main. He brought home enough gold to back to England to keep their military budget for years. He basically funded the entire Navy of England at that time. And so he did have the money. The only thing is that he didn't have the motive. And I couldn't also account for any space in his life that, say, a year or two, we wouldn't know where he was. When he did get home, Elizabeth allowed him to keep a huge amount of the treasure, and he bought his rival's home. He was very ostentatious in spending the money, built a water supply system for his village and everything, so he wouldn't have had the need to hide it anywhere. The Knights Templar, then, it was kind of
Let's get into a secret voyage that occurred about 100 years before Columbus, the official story of Columbus discovering America in 1390. Let's talk about that secret voyage.
Yeah, there was a person named Prince Henry Sinclair, who probably wasn't really a prince, but he got titled that. He basically owned the Orkneys. He owned Caithness in the north of Scotland. His family had a lot of property in Edinburgh, and his family was probably the second most powerful family in Scotland, although they never rose to the first most powerful. And when I first heard about him, he came over in 1398. He brought one Italian with him out of two that were doing some exploring for him around his lands and up to Greenland. And he did land in Nova Scotia in 1398. The area has been mapped by the Zeno brothers, that one of them accompanied him on the journey. And there's a lot of evidence ranging from Nova Scotia all the way down to Westford, Massachusetts, that he had been there. I really didn't understand. I didn't put two and two together at that point until later I found out that Henry Sinclair was of a family that were instrumental in creating the Knights Templar. And then it dawned on me that they may have had something worth hiding. And I went back even further than that. When the Knights Templar were broken up in 1307, a whole bunch of ships left La Rochelle, France, with the treasure from the Paris Temple. The king arrived a little bit too late. He arrested a couple of people, but all the treasure had been gone. And the two places that people give as his destination, one is Scotland, the other is Portugal. And there's evidence that the Sinclairs were certainly very powerful in Scotland, but they were also well represented in Portugal as part of their being in the Knights Templar.
Right. Now, on this initial voyage in 1398, there's a really interesting story you relate about a disappearing island called Icaria. Why don't you tell us a bit about their landing on this island and what happened to the island, if it disappeared, or where is it now?
The story was actually recorded by one of the Zeno brothers, and it's one of the things that actually cast a lot of doubt on the voyage, that there was this island of Icaria. They weren't allowed to land on it. The island was actually pretty big, and they were threatened by the king. The island was made up of white men, so it wasn't, you know, that it was so close to North America. It was much closer to Greenland. And we're finding out that there were quite a few islands there. There were something called the Gunnabourne Skerries, which were actually at one point about 10 feet underwater, but at one point they were above water and 65 miles long. So the changing coastline up there and the changing islands is it's really an interesting thing, and so it shouldn't cast doubt on the story. There's actually something that called Surtsey, which was an island that just popped up out of the water near Iceland. There's another place called Rockall, which is a gigantic rock that comes out of the sea, and people have claimed it to be its own country, although it's pretty much uninhabitable. But it's not unusual to have those kind of islands in the North Atlantic, especially in volcanic areas.
Right. Now, what is some of the early evidence of the Scottish in the Nova Scotia area? Wasn't there a tower that you researched in Rhode Island and some relics indicating they were there before Columbus?
See, I believe what happened was the Sinclairs originally came over in 1398. At some point, I'm guessing 1441, they decided that this was the time that we had to move the treasure that we took from the Paris Temple. We had to move it to safer places. So in 1441, the Sinclair family actually brought hundreds of people to Roslyn in Scotland, which is just outside Edinburgh, and they were supposedly going to create this new chapel. Work on the chapel actually didn't start to 1446. So I believe at that point another voyage was made. These people came over. At that point they probably started or maybe even did constructed the entire money pit on Nova Scotia. Subsequent voyages were made into the 1500s. In 1545, Oliver Sinclair was a prisoner of the king in London. He decided to request a pass because someone in his family had died. He was allowed to leave prison, go up to Scotland, and he disappeared. And he was at one time the military leader in England, so it was too much of a prominent person to just stay disappeared unless he went someplace else. But I believe that several voyages were made. Some of the evidence is in Westford. There's actually an effigy carved into a rock, and the effigy is of a knight. His coat of arms resembles that of Sir James Gunn, who was Sinclair's lieutenant in the Orkneys. The Gunn family has still maintained a very strong presence in the Orkneys, and they actually have their own family museum that in part commemorates his role in the voyage to the Americas. Further south in Falls River, Massachusetts, they found a coat, a suit of armor, which is kind of unusual to be there. It was held in the library in Harvard until they had a fire and it disappeared after that. But more remarkable is in Newport, Rhode Island, there's actually, it's a Templar baptistery, and they use these things kind of as a purification ritual, but they also use them to watch the stars. And this is part of the mathematical, astronomical knowledge that's conveyed through masonry, which is kind of an outgrowth of the Knights Templar. The same exact kind of temples are found, one in the Orkneys, one is in Ireland, another, there's actually four on an island called Bornholm, which was the subject of a book called The Temple of Secret Island, and in Tomar, Portugal, which was a main preceptory of the Templar Order. So this exact same thing to be found there is remarkable, and the first time it was noted on a map was in 1524 by Veranzano, who called it a Norman villa, but I think it was just he represented it on the map, but he knew a little bit more than he was letting on as far as what it actually represented.
Right, and the reason why I believe your theory is correct in your book, which is called The Lost Treasure of the Knights Templar, we're speaking with Stephen Sora, the author of the book on the Odyssey Radio Show. I believe so because when you talk about the temple in Scotland, the Roslyn Chapel, it has a lot of elaborate traps and kind of chutes and the same type of engineering, doesn't it, as the Oak Island trap?
When I visited Roslyn, one thing that I was looking for on my own was that there are supposed to be caves there that could hold more than 1,000 men at one time. And it may have been those caves around Roslyn that actually held the gold and silver that came out of the temple and anything else they had, which they had treasures from Jerusalem. Some people think the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant, things like that might have been there. Titus brought these things home from Rome, and they were looted at that point. He brought them home to Rome. They were looted from there and brought to the south of France. Other things, the Knights Templar spent 9 years digging in the Temple of Solomon, and so, you know, who knows what other treasures they could have came up with. All of these things were hidden at Roslyn. Roslyn's actually, it's a very spooky place. I went to a sub-basement there, and this was where they actually were still finding different burials, and they would have them when the legs are crossed on the effigy above the grave. That means that the person was in the Knights Templar. And so these things have just been unearthed in the last few years.
It's not a normal Christian church in any sense of the manner. It's full of all sort of pagan and Gnostic and Freemasonic type of symbols, isn't it?
It is truly amazing. And the carvings there are just unbelievable. In wood, in some of the furniture that's in there, and also in stone, in the floor, in the columns that go up to the ceiling. There's Celtic severed heads, you know, looking down on you in there. There's what's called the Pillar of the Apprentice, which is, a Masonic thing. So it's really, it'd be hard to define it just as a Christian church.
Oh, no, they were really reaching back to the pagan roots. So what I want to ask now is, what do you believe is, if you could speculate, I mean, somebody obviously went to a tremendous amount of trouble to hide this treasure overseas. What do you think is down there?
Number one would be like an earthly treasure, like silver and gold. Number two would be religious treasures that the Knights Templar actually did own. Another thing, they pledged jewels of kings and queens. The Templars were actually the first branch banking in the world. So you could deposit, say, your wealth, whether it's in gold and silver or jewelry or diamonds or whatever, in one branch of the Templar and then kind of borrow money or withdraw money at another branch. If you were a minor royalty in France and you were heading to the Holy Land, obviously this wouldn't want to be something that you carried on horseback or on a ship. So you would have that protected by the Templars, and then in Jerusalem you could take out a treasure. Other things, I think over the years, a group of people that later emerged as the Royal Society, but along the way they were kind of like an underground college of people that were attempting to be free thinkers. We have to remember at that time that the Catholic Church, they executed Bruno, they imprisoned Galileo for things like saying the sun is the center of the universe and not that the sun revolves around the earth, but the earth revolves around the sun. So any kind of knowledge, whether it was of the human body, whether it was of the real geography of the world, was subject to the Inquisition. And so at that time, a lot of people banded together, and Freemasonry was one thing that kind of facilitated this. And so there were other things that may have been concealed there. One thing that I've been doing a lot of research on, both when I started the book and still now, is who wrote the plays of Shakespeare. I believe that most of them were written by Sir Francis Bacon, and those may have been imported to the Americas also. And I've subsequently found out that there are other vaults in the Americas where these things may be hidden. One is the Bruton Vault in Williamsburg, Virginia, which they found it empty, but it may have been a repository for something in the past. Another is in Ephrata in Pennsylvania, that there may be underground vaults there that mystics, specifically Rosicrucians, brought over to the Americas, and Sir Francis Bacon was part of the Rosicrucian movement. So it could be a lot of interesting things. I think the gold and silver aspect may be something that could have actually been taken out again and moved somewhere else. I'm not of any certainty that it's still there to be found in Oak Island.
Sure. Let me run a theory by you. In my research, I know that the Knights Templar, nine of them were at Solomon's Temple digging for 9 years. And I know that there were a lot of pagan gods and worship underneath Solomon's Temple, a lot of evidence of that. Could it be that the church did not, the church just wanted people to worship Jehovah and did not want any knowledge of these other pagan gods and this polytheism?
That's very true. And what was happening was Europeans were not very literate. They were not allowed to read the Bible. Generally, priests didn't read the Bible or in a lot of cases know how to read it. And so when these crusaders, both from the level of people, kings like Frederick and the knights from France that were in the small order at that time, when they came over, it was their eyes are really open to a whole bunch of new things. And it changed their concept of history. It changed their concept of religion. And so they were bringing back these ideas. And so at the time, the church really had to kind of fight to squelch this knowledge that was coming back. It opened up a gateway of Greek and Roman literature that had been lost to Europe for centuries, and now it was coming back, and people like the Medicis were paying fortunes to have people that could translate it into the modern Italian or modern English so it could be understood. So this was causing the church quite a bit of grief.
Right. Now, there's another aspect to this puzzle. I know in early writings they referred to Nova Scotia as Arcadia. So why don't you talk about the René Le Château mystery, the castle in France, and the painting that refers to Arcadia?
The René Le Château basically started around 1898, I think it was, that Father Sornia came to that parish. He was renovating the altar of the parish church and came across some parchments. He went to St. Sulpice, which has always been a hotbed of modernist thought, which the Catholic Church doesn't like, and another borderline heretical activity. And there, he might have been bribed to stop bringing out some information, or he might have been rewarded for finding some information. But whatever the case was, he was a multimillionaire a couple of years later, and he was rebuilding his whole village and building a villa for himself. And so nobody really knows the whole extent of what went on at René Le Château. Part of what he found was a painting called the shepherds of Arcadia. And Arcadia represented a couple things back there. One was that an Italian writer that originally did the story of Arcadia basically was an idyllic kind of land where people were not affected by governments and religion that were just all-powerful. And so this concept of a different world kind of went a long way. And so when the whoever it was that landed there, say it was the Sinclair people, and they had been aware of the Arcadia story, and when the natives that they met there said, called the land Acadia, this was the proverbial light bulb going on for them, that this was the promised land that we reach. Here we can create a new world that's kind of free from all this. And Verrazzano picked up that whole thing. Verrazzano was Italian, but where he lived, a lot of people were in different groups that would be relatively close to what we call the Cathars, the pure ones. In Italy, they were called the Waldensians. And basically, they kind of believed that you didn't need a priest or a bishop to intercede with you for God, that there was a direct ability to go to God. And so this was another level of thought. Verrazzano then talked the French king into kind of sponsoring a trip to the Americas, and I believe it was specifically for finding the village that the Templars had created in Acadia, which was named later by Verrazzano as Rhode Island after the Greek, because it fit into this whole idyllic story. So it kind of, you know, was a big circle of this. This was like later the theme in Sir Francis Bacon's writing, what he called the New Atlantis. Was basically the same thing, a land where the king wouldn't interfere with the learned people that were trying to know the world better, and certainly no religion would interfere with that as well.
Absolutely. So one other interesting clue at René Le Château was one of the children is in kind of like a statue, has a Scottish plaid skirt on. It's almost like they're pointing toward Scotland and the Roslyn Chapel.
The Sinclair family had a lot to do with René Le Château, and even today, I think one branch of the Sinclairs actually live in the area, and the woman that was kind of prominent in the family in France, she was someone that was involved in this modernist movement also, which it shouldn't really be considered anti-Catholic, but the Catholic Church considers it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So they're still very much involved in that way. And Sinclairs were also on the island of Madeira, which is a really interesting story. And I covered that in my kind of follow-up book to The Lost Treasure of the Knights Templar, and it was the search for the treasure colony. The one of the Sinclairs married a Drummond, and this is Elizabeth Sinclair. She was the daughter of Henry that came over in 1398. She married John Drummond. And at that time in Scotland, pretty much the first son got everything. So John Drummond went to Madeira. The family had a big presence in there, and later his name was changed a bit, mostly because they were Portuguese there. But he married into the Perestrello family. Perestrellos were actually Italians in the employ of the Portuguese king. And a Perestrello daughter is who Columbus married. Columbus, on his first trip to Madeira with his new wife and his mother-in-law, was presented with a gift of his dead father-in-law's maps. His dead father-in-law was a Knights Templar, and actually a Knight of Christ, which was kind of the Templar version of the Knights Templar. And so his maps may have really been a lot of secret maps of the New World that has never been unearthed before.
Absolutely. Last question as we're winding down. Bring us up to 2007, Nova Scotia, Oak Island. Who owns it? Who's working on the treasure? What's happening there now?
Unfortunately, a few years ago, everything got stopped because the two men that were really the principals, one was Dan Blankenship, the other is David Tobias. They're both in their 80s. They were feuding, and they actually wouldn't stand in the same room with each other, so when they had meetings of the Oak Island Tour Company, which is what they called it. It was based on the Oak Island Exploration Company, which was the name before that. These two men wouldn't be in the same room. Someone would have to go back and forth to relay what they were discussing. And so Tobias's family, even though he's a self-made millionaire, I guess his family didn't want him sinking millions more into the money pit, so they kind of got him out of it, and he just sold his lots. So on that side of the island, there's Dan Blankenship, and there's a new person from Michigan. They call it the Michigan Group, but it's actually just a couple people. They have one side of the island. They're not going to be digging or anything till 2008. They're actually talking about drilling something into the earth that would be possibly 15 feet in diameter, that they could actually pull out all the dirt out of there and kind of build their own huge tunnel underground. The other side of the island is owned by a guy named Fred Nolan. Fred Nolan is really placing a lot of stock in the Templar symbols and Freemason symbols that he found on the island. His son-in-law just bought another island and the rights to hunt for treasure there. These islands, this is very hard to believe, but these islands may actually be connected by underground tunnels. And
wow.
One of the islands, and I'm not sure if it's the island that Mr. Young just bought, actually had a circular staircase in the ground that just stops, and no one was able to figure out, you know, if there was ever a tunnel that it went down to or what. But I have a feeling in the next few years, improved technology, more money to chase after what's down there, we may be getting some new news.
Well, that's great. I'd like to read your next book and have you back on. But this is Stephen Sora. The book is titled The Lost Treasure of the Knights Templar. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so that was The Mystery of Oak Island, and he was really a fascinating guest. And so we're going to have a little pause here, and our co-host, Candia Sanders, will come on the show. She is an intuitive, and she will have free readings on the air. This is a chance, this is a really great deal to get a free reading, so I want you to call into the show and talk to her in about 5 minutes or so. Call 877-876-5227. And we will shift over to that portion of the show. So anyway, I've been gone for a week or two. It's great to be back with you guys. And I have two DVDs on ancient mysteries. I have The Sands of Time and The Temples of Stone. And they can be found at my website, fountainsofuse.net. Or just go to the BBS main page, and there's a link right there. You can read my bio and find out all about me. So I've really been intrigued by the Nova Scotia Oak Island. My theory, we heard, you know, Stephen Sora's theory. I believe that the Knights Templar did indeed have a secret voyage to America. It all makes sense within the time frame. They built elaborate underground shafts that were very similar to the Roslyn Chapel in the 1400s in Scotland. So it makes sense that they had the engineering capabilities to go to Nova Scotia. They had the men and the ships and the means and the materials and the engineering expertise to build this elaborate treasure shaft. And they certainly had secrets that the church wanted back. The Knights Templar have always had these secret documents. And I believe it's about, you know, certainly genealogies and the fact that Christ's relatives may have survived the crucifixion. And they certainly had a much more direct type of Christianity that the church wanted to wipe out. But I also believe that they uncovered the secrets of the Anunnaki, this other group that used to be on the planet, that Jehovah was one of the Anunnaki, that he wasn't the supreme god of the universe, but actually one of these lower entities that was involved with the Jews and the Sumerians, and along with many other gods, many other of the lower gods, not to be confused with the supreme god of the universe. So that's my whole ancient astronaut theory, and there's many of us that believe that and write books and DVDs on it. Of course, Eric von Däniken, Chariots of the Gods, was kind of the breakthrough work in 1967. Probably the leading researcher today would have to be Graham Hancock. I would highly recommend reading Graham Hancock's books. And my DVDs are more of a summary of all of this different material. So once again, my DVD is The Sands of Time and The Temples of Stone. And I have all these photographs from all around the world of ancient monuments. We really have been left with major, major clues all around the world. And boy, if there's one family that plays a key linchpin role in all of this, it is the Sinclair or the St. Clair family. that the author Stephen Storer was talking about tonight. They were the powerful Knights Templar family, and they were the first Freemasons. They created that bridge between the Knights Templar and Freemasonry in 1450 in Roslyn Chapel in Scotland. And it's interesting, he refers to it as kind of a scary, spooky church. It certainly is bizarre. Just to give you one example, there's a pagan deity called the Green Man. He's kind of like a god of nature. And there are over 100 statues or carvings of the Green Man all throughout the Roslyn Chapel. So there's certainly many, many aspects and references hidden and open to paganism. And all of the deities that people used to worship on this planet long before Christianity got established. And as we know, you know, Easter and Christmas and Halloween, these were all pagan holidays that were all changed, of course, when the Christian church established the powerful ties. So it really strongly plays into my theory that the Knights Templar do have all of these secrets of the church that are buried at the bottom of Oak Island in Canada or Nova Scotia. So, it's close to us here in the United States, and it may well be worth a trip to find Oak Island. There's over 300 islands off the coast of Nova Scotia. But to go over there and to check it out and see this shaft, but it's really amazing. I have maps of it, and there's platforms of oak logs and coconut fiber and blue putty and clay and all these different materials from all around the world that were very elaborate, and they just keep going down deeper and deeper below 100 feet until finally it floods. You cannot, every bucket of water you pull out of there, two buckets go in. So, you know, it's an elaborate trap. Obviously, they went to a great deal of engineering and trouble. So I believe it's more than just gold and silver. I really do. I think these documents that were found at René Le Château that talk about these genealogies of Jesus and, once again, the kind of secret history of the church and the presence of this other group on our planet, the Anunnaki, the group that built the pyramids all around the globe and had all of this ancient advanced technology to build Stonehenge and Easter Island and all of these other monuments. So, Candia may or may not be joining us. I didn't actually talk to her this week. So I want to remind everybody to go to the main webpage on bbs.com, bbsradio.com, excuse me. And Don has a lot of really great websites that he's linked up to. There's some 911 Truth websites. Okay, we're going to go off the air for just a few seconds, and we'll be back with Candia. And we're back with the Odyssey Radio Show. This is the next portion of our show. We're bringing on our intuitive co-host, Candia Sanders. Welcome back.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing tonight?
Great. I've opened up the phone lines. People are going to start calling in, but I really want to hear about the Body Mind Expo in Portland. How did that go?
Well, we've had a Portland one, and we just came off a Seattle show as well. They were awesome shows. We had over 120 vendors, all different kinds of new modalities out there, and, of course, elixirs and jewelry and, the latest and greatest in the vitamin area. They're very fun. For those who have not ever attended a Body, Mind, and Spirit Expo, I'd highly recommend doing so. You can go online to their website to see if there's a show in your town or going to be, because they are all across America, and it's bmse.net, bodymindandspirit.net. So you can.
Okay, great. Let's give out the phone lines. This is your chance to get a free reading from Candia, 877-876-5227. So what came up when you spoke at the, do we have a call?
Hello.
Hi, do we have a call?
Yes, we do.
Okay,
hi.
Sure. Go ahead.
Welcome to our show. What's your name?
Hi, my name is Christine.
I'm sorry, Christine?
Yes.
Yes. Go ahead, Christine.
Great.
Hello?
Christine, what's
your question?
Okay, yeah, my question is, I'm just starting going through negotiations with a divorce, and I'm currently actually have jumped into a relationship, woman-to-woman relationship, and wanting to know if that is a good direction to go in, and also this person is also in my same profession that I'm studying. so it's all kind of come very quickly, and I'm wondering if this is the right direction to go in.
Well, it feels as if, so please take this well, okay?
Yeah.
It feels as if it's a quick knee-jerk reaction because it's safe, it feels comfortable. You're coming out of a challenging marriage, and then you go into divorce, and I'll be honest with you, I don't care if it's an easy divorce or a very difficult divorce. Divorce sucks. It's very challenging no matter how you do it. It's emotionally challenging, and it can take you down a spiral. It's a very difficult process. I wouldn't recommend it, and yet I do, ironically. And so I get a sense that you're trying to find your way as if there's no solid ground right now. And so to respond to this woman, I'm not gender biased in any way. I sure don't care. To me, it's about the soul connection.
Yeah.
So don't take it that way. I just get the sense that it's a real quick fix for right now. So and there's nothing wrong with that. We all need to have safety in our lives. My best invitation to you, though, is to go in and be the observer as well as the participant so that you can see how you are reacting and responding to the situation rather than just diving in with your feet first and not looking. It's one of those things that could go for a juncture in your life. It doesn't feel like it's a long-term, forever kind of thing. And also it feels as if there are no accidents. There's a reason that you're connecting with one another. You're both giving to one another something new and exciting that is fulfilling and is nurturing to an aspect of you. It feels where this is fulfilling you is actually in your solar plexus, in your third chakra, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
because that's where we hold our fear and our nurturing. And, of course, that's where do we stuff our food, but our third chakra, our stomach. And so what she is doing for you is providing a panacea. It's like Pepto-Bismol on a stomach.
Yeah.
Is what she feels like she is doing for you. So from that aspect, that's a positive thing. Like I said, when it comes to healing from a divorce, depending on how long you've been, there's an old formula, being one who's also been through divorce, that I listen to, because for every year you've been divorced, you need to times it by 3, and that's how many months that you need to go through, to go through the grieving period. I didn't finish that sentence, because it takes that long to literally get through all the process of letting go and getting all the ties cut. Now, what's fascinating, too, energetically, there is something very, very powerful with divorce when it finally comes through. Even though it's a piece of paper, there is still an energetic connection. You will find that you will shift when that final process has come down. So in the meantime, enjoy, but understand the reasons why you're there, too. Be really, I guess more than anything, my invitation to you is to really look in the mirror and to stay real focused on you so that you are doing what's best for you.
Yeah. Great. Oh, well, now that she's in the same profession, though, and she's willing to help guide me through my teaching, too.
Well, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
Like I said, there are no accidents.
Yeah.
And she's nurturing. I just, like I said, my invitation to you is it's not about being cautious so much as just being smart.
And smart,
yeah. Just feeling it through and don't go into knee-jerk, because it's real easy just to dive in when it's not always, there's always a bigger picture.
Yeah, I hear.
I know Chris a little bit. Do you see her? She has to move out because of the divorce. Do you see her living on her own or with this woman? What do you think is better?
Well, you know what? My first thing, invitation, is for you to live on your own, because you need the space and the time for you to regroup, for your soul to heal. And if it's meant for you guys to live together, do it a year, 2 years down the line. But this gives you the time to breathe, to be on your own, to regather yourself.
Yeah.
Because there'll be times that even though you're involved with someone else, for you to recapture who you are just by you, just connected to you and to Source and to the planet. And nobody else can go through that but you.
Yeah. All right.
I mean, it's easy to move in, absolutely. But take it from someone who's walked the line.
Yeah.
Living on your own is the smartest thing you can do.
Yeah. Well, great. Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's,
thanks for calling.
That's what I told Chris, too. Thanks, Chris.
Can I ask you
take
one more
care.
Question?
Sure.
Our question
go ahead.
Would be,
yeah, sure.
Also a professional musician and want to know where that, what direction is that going in?
I'm sorry, what direction your...
My music is going in.
Now, is this what you want to do for a profession?
I have been a professional musician all my life, and it changes. Musicians work and don't work and work and don't work, and I'm sort of in the process of working for a large company facilitating and teaching, but I showed up for class and didn't have any students. So I'm trying to figure out where is this all going.
Well, I'll be honest with you. When I hear you with your music, you know why it goes in and out? It's because you don't believe in it enough. You doubt yourself. You know you have talent, but you doubt your abilities. Because you doubt yourself, it will absolutely sink from the weight. And until you wrap yourself around it 100% with passion, it's never going to blossom in the way that you want to. You're caught between two worlds. You want to be able to do it, and yet in your head you go logical, you go to left brain thinking,
yes.
And you're going, but I can't make enough to survive
because
right. We need a roof and da-da-da-da food, pay the bills. And so you're caught in between both worlds.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those is for you right now what would be it feels like a really smart and good way to go is to stick with your job that you're doing and then do your music for fun until you feel so confident, so powerful in it that you can step into it full time. So that you're that way you're bridging both worlds, because otherwise you're going to keep going into the sink mode because you're going to sabotage because you don't think it's possible. But the more you do it on the side for fun,
yeah.
Because then it's not life or death.
Yeah, I hear you.
Then your confidence, self-esteem, self-confidence builds.
Yeah, I have many confidence with it because I've been with it all my life. It just it evolves all the time in different projects.
Mm-hmm.
And
but it hasn't absolutely blossomed like you want it.
Yeah. So
and that's why.
Yeah.
It's not that you're not talented. Absolutely not.
Right.
That's why you've been in it. This is about you believing 100% enough in it to do it full time for money.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. You're
thanks,
welcome.
Chris. Bye. Take care.
Okay. Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. There's an opening to talk to Candia. Please call us at 877-876-5227. So while we're waiting, why don't you tell me about kind of what came through when you spoke to all those people at the Body, Mind, Spirit Expo?
You know, it's funny. That's a great question because in Portland, the class I had probably, 65, 70 people in the class. And
mm-hmm.
Everybody was just dialed. They were very excited to be there. And so the energy in the room was high and it was very connected. And so we kind of went into what I would say much more esoteric concepts of how do we, it sounds like the secret, but, we didn't get into what I call the secret. I asked people where they were in their lives and what is it. Of course, the big pushes for all of us are finances and health
mm-hmm.
and relationships. And so invariably, it all goes back to that. Now, so we kind of meshed over all of those concepts, and I was on a roll. In Seattle, it was very interesting, is that the group was smaller, because just the whole group in general was smaller. And what I loved, it was this group was very inquisitive, asked a lot of questions, and it ended up being very matter-of-fact, practical questions on how do we tap into our intuition. What could each of them do to tap into that? And so it ended up being a very interactive group because it was very small. I think there may have been 20 people instead. So
right.
That completely different groups, different energy, which is always how I base. I never want to know what I'm going to say when I get up in front of a room.
You and I are such the opposites.
I don't know.
That's why we're funny as co-hosts, because I plan everything out and then you're spontaneous, so it works well together.
Yeah, and you know it's so funny that you say that. My partner doesn't think I'm spontaneous at all, and I'm thinking, oh my God, my whole life is absolutely spontaneity. You know, I have a general idea, but then it's like until that minute, I don't know what's going to happen. And so,
right.
But it works. It works for me. If I had to sit down and write out a script, I would probably go crazy.
Absolutely.
So whatever.
Well, we have time for one or two more calls. Please call in and get a free reading right now, 877-876-5227. So basically, you know, you're a very dynamic live speaker. So, I mean, did you get some really interesting questions from the audience? Anything you want to share? Or?
Well, I'm trying to think about, see, you know what, to be honest with you, you know what happens to me? It's like when I do a reading, I literally kind of go off. So I don't always remember what I talk about. I know it was good, though. Portland was really good. And, in fact, I got some great letters back from people because they ended up talking about how they were incorporating different aspects of manifesting into their own lives. And everybody says, you just walk your passion, which I do. I mean, it's my life. It's like you, what you do, it's your life. And so,
absolutely.
Well, the one thing I was going to segue to is if you happen to be in Washington or Oregon, because we happen to live, Mike and I happen to live in the Northwest. I live in Vancouver, and Mike lives in Portland. I am going to be teaching a class on the weekend after this, on Saturday. I think it's the 11th, not the 12th. I think it's the 11th. And it's a class on relationships and relationship to yourself first and then to your partner. You know, if you don't have a partner in your life, the next level out, to children, to parents, all the way out.
So, oh, do we have a caller?
For those who are interested.
Hi, yes.
Hi, go ahead, caller.
Hi, my name is Diane, and I was calling because I was, I've been having a hard time getting back into the workforce.
And how long have you been out of work?
How long have I been out of work?
Uh-huh.
For 3 years.
Wow, long time. So, now this is going to be a very left brain question. Where are you living now?
I'm living in Oakland. Yes, Oakland, California.
Okay, because that has a bearing on things too. I mean, I do believe that to manifest things, you have to also look at your environment too. There are many factors to things, and so if you're in an environment, for example. Here in Oregon, you know, in California, we've got a lot of small towns that may have 150 people, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to have a lot of job opportunities. That's why I asked. So if you're living in a city, that should help. Now, what's gone on in your life before? Did you quit your job or did you, were you let go?
I quit. I have a real, I don't know. I have a problem working for others.
I was going to say you have a problem with authority is what I was going to say.
Yeah,
and so you got fed up and you got twisted about something and you get on your high horse, sorry, just calling it as it is, and so you quit. So what happens then, you end up going in a spiral, you know, because what happens is then you're always right, so it's more difficult to work for other people. So if that's the case, have you considered creating something on your own?
Yes, and I come up with a million and one things, but nothing that's like, nothing that I feel that I would be like, okay, I'm going to stick to it.
Well, see, because that's the next thing. To create something, you have to take action, and that's what's, there's the bigger issue on all of this, actually, is you go round and round and round like a merry-go-round, a washing machine, you know, doing the wash cycle. However, it's jumping off that merry-go-round and taking action to do something else, and that's where you are second-guessing yourself because you start going into judgment and you go into perfection. Both of those patterns for you started when you were a kid. It feels like about 10, 11, 12. All of those patterns started getting more and more into place because becoming the judge, the critic, is what is the process. When you can't take authority, you're always right. You have to be right.
Mm-hmm.
And the perfectionist, because if you're going to start something, and it better be perfect. And so what happens is you're caught on this cycle of not taking any steps at all. So you need to backtrack, find out where that started from, and say, okay, stop already. And I'm going to be real firm with you on this, and that is you're very hard on yourself. You criticize other people or don't think they're good enough, but in reality, you're really hard on yourself. So every day, for you to get a new job, is for you to say how wonderful you are. Look yourself in the mirror. Put stickers all over the walls and your mirrors of your car, you know, the visor on your car when the sun comes out, put a visor. You are awesome, girl. You're fabulous. You're talented. And then the other thing is I want you to take the time and write down every skill, tool, talent that you have from the time you were 3 years old all the way through. And start putting them all together.
Let me explain, because you hit the nail kind of right on the head. As a kid around that age, I was abused by my aunt. Mm-hmm. Really bad. And I'm going to tell you, I've really been working on it. I've really been working on forgiveness, because I allowed them to tell me that I wasn't going to be nothing. You know, and it just, I was, to them, I was this beautiful girl. You know, I don't know. It just messed me up as a kid, and as an adult, I'm carrying it with me, and I realize it. I really do. I realize it, and I'm trying every time. I'd say, okay, I forgive you, and I want to move on. It's hard because I said
the biggest person you need to forgive is you. Is you. You got to forgive you. That's it. Forgiveness of the other people, yes, but forgive you first, because what you need to forgive in yourself is that you're not perfect. None of us are perfect. Besides, perfection is boring. You know, it's life is messy. Life is fun. Life is wild. And so when things aren't perfect, that doesn't mean that you're not fabulous. You are fabulous. You're wonderful. And for you to look in the mirror and say, I forgive you for not being perfect, because that's what was drilled into you, that you weren't good enough. And that's not the truth. We're all good enough. We just have to believe we are. So every day, it's a matter of turning the kaleidoscope and putting that belief pattern back in. Forgive you, and then the rest becomes easy, because then you forgive your aunt for all of her transgressions, because she was operating out of fear because she also had been abused. You know, if you can understand that, it doesn't make it right, but it's easier then to forgive. And then you say, okay, guess what? I have a brain. I have two hands. I got feet. I can move. I can create all kinds of things. And if you need to, you go to the library. You study up on books. You start expanding your brain, taking the time. And the more, you know what? The more you do that, the better you will feel about yourself. Get your butt out the door and take walks. Get some exercise going. Get the blood flowing in your body. Start moving, breathing, expressing yourself, realizing how great it is to live here, and then a job will come. But a job's not going to come when you're sitting there not thinking anything will ever happen. You've got to make it happen. So go to the library, start writing down your list of all the incredible things that you have done in your life, and what you have learned. Every single thing you've done, you've learned from. Even if, you know, for example, I was a stay-at-home mom for a long time, but you learned from being a stay-at-home mom.
Yes,
you learn how to multitask.
Yes.
So think about all of those skills and write those down.
Okay.
And you
do see, though, like for me, music and write. I used to, when I was real little, I can remember I used to have a binder. It was pink, and I used to write song after song after song after song after song. And I don't know at what point I stopped writing, but it was all what I was feeling, you know, at that time in my life.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, what you can do with that is find a job so your self-esteem starts going up. With your music, it's one of those things where you get your foot in the door, you start going to clubs, meeting other musicians. You need to have it happen. You got to get out there. That goes back to taking action. It's about getting your butt out the door. You've got to connect in with people. Study up on it. No, I mean, Einstein didn't become Einstein by sitting and doing nothing. He had to think. He had to read. Michelangelo didn't paint the Sistine Chapel by hanging around and doing nothing. He studied and studied and practiced and painted. To do it, you have to do it over and over and over and over again.
Okay.
So that's why getting motivated. Get up in the morning and say, okay, it's a new day. Every day is a brand new day. And you can do this.
Okay.
Okay.
Because I do, I try to do that, but it's like you said,
I beat myself up. No tries. Just do it.
Okay.
Go to the library. Libraries are cheap. And you can go there and you can study. And that's why I want you to write the list. And in your list, I want you to think about everything that you're good at as well as everything you want to do.
Okay.
And then go read about it. Learn about it. No more sitting in front of the television.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I appreciate you calling. This is awesome.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Mike, are you still with me? Mike's not still with me. Must have gotten cut off here. Well, as far as I know, this is Candia, and I'm still with the Odyssey program tonight. I want to thank the people that called in and asked their questions. We have, if there's anybody else that wants to put in one more phone call tonight, that would be great. Otherwise, I will say adieu for another week. So I'll give you 30 more seconds here. I want to thank my co-host, Mike, for sharing the show with me. He's a great guy. Check out his website and check out his DVDs on his Sands of Time on the Ancient Mysteries. It's great. Also, please check out my website, which is www.candiasanders.com, and you can read stories and information about one, who I am, but also stories of other people and the things that they have gone through and the things they have learned and the transformations in their life. It's actually very fun to read through. And then if you are ever interested in a personalized reading, please give me a phone call at 360-608-9555. Or again, you can contact me through my website. And my 30 seconds are up, so I wish everybody a fabulous and wonderful week. And please stay tuned to other wonderful programs here on BBS.com. And look for us. Stay tuned to us next week on the Odyssey program.
Hello?
Oh, great. I've got another caller. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Hi, this is Candy, and you are?
Hi, I'm Mark.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for calling. You are lucky. Let me tell you, you're lucky. I was down on that 30-second drop there. I'm going, another 30 seconds, and I'm gone. You're good. You're good. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Shoreline, Washington.
Oh,
are you in Vancouver,
great.
Washington?
I'm in Vancouver, and you're where?
I'm in Shoreline.
Shoreline?
It's north of Seattle.
Okay, great. So how are you tonight?
I'm pretty good. I've come down with a cold the last couple of days, so
you got a virus.
Is it?
It's not bacterial, spiral. It's not bacterial.
Okay.
So what you can do with that, before you ask me your question, what you can do about that is to get your system revved back up again, is to go to the center of your chest, as if where your heart is, if your heart were in the center of your chest, and then go up about 2 inches, and that's where your thymus gland is. Your thymus gland is part of the endocrine system that is your immune booster, okay? It's that's number one job is to keep your immune system up. What you do is you start tapping that, tap it off and on during the course of the day, and it will help get your system moving again. Also, if you were a female and had a bra, okay, imagine the bottom of the bra line underneath your arms, and these are your spleen points. And if you tap that also, because your spleen is your recycle bin, gets things moving. So if you tap those out, that will help you move through the virus much more quickly so you can get past your cold.
Okay, well, I'll definitely try that.
Okay, it works. So what's your question?
Well, I guess along with being just a cold, which kind of emphasized certain things, I feel kind of stagnant. So I was just wondering what I should do to start getting my spirit to start feel like I'm growing again.
This has been going on for a while, though, hasn't it? This is not about the cold.
Right.
It's like you are becoming more and more what I would call, it's as if the dam has plugged and you're in a cesspool where you're not moving. Everything is very stagnant. And why is that, if you think about it? What is it that has absolutely stopped you cold? What fear is stopping you? You have to really identify, what is it you're so afraid of about moving forward? Because what it's doing, that's why you got the cold too, because it's like, well, fine, if you're not moving, I won't either. And your system just stopped. Your lymphatics have gotten plugged up. And what you can do about your lymphatics is to by your neck, the base of your neck, as you massage those points, it's where the trapezius muscle hits, and it, you know, it feels like a muscle, but it's actually your lymphatic points where they get blocked, and massage those out. And you can take a like a rubber ball or even a ping pong ball or a golf ball, and you stand up against a wall and you massage the points right next to your spine, not your spine, but next to your spine, those muscles all the way down, and that will help get the lymphatics moving, which is basically an analogy, a metaphor for you to get you moving as well. You know, you have stopped yourself. It's like, I don't get a sense that you're happy in your job.
Right.
Are you in a relationship?
No.
No?
No.
I didn't think so. You feel like you're much more of a loner, and you've withdrawn from society. Why? What's going on? It's like, it's time. It's just like the other gal I just was talking to. It is time. I'm one of those who calls people on the carpet. You know, I'm one of those is, in my book, there. I mean, we all have issues. We've all had our share of challenges throughout life. Most people, I haven't heard of any perfect childhoods. Most of us come from some kind of dysfunction somewhere. So we need to process that, look at it, and then look at where you are right now. I feel very strongly that what's going on for you is you, even though you've isolated yourself more and more because it's safe, I feel that the opposite is really what your heart's desire is. If you could create what you really want, would be to, not that you need huge social parties of 40, 50 people, but smaller groups of interaction with friends, gathering, going out, doing something that's fun. And going out is not what I'm saying. It's like going to the bars and drinking. That's not my idea of going out. I mean, going out could be going out and listening to a jazz concert or a picnic in the park or a concert in the park or bicycling along the lake or climbing Mount Rainier or whatever. I see you really visualizing that's what you'd love to do rather than staying more and more isolated. So the bottom line for you is to identify, just like I told the last caller, what is it that you want out of life? It's not what you're doing now. You're locking yourself up with fears. And so the first thing you have to do is take the first step. So with you, I'm going to say the same thing. Start writing down what you want to do. Start visualizing the changes you want to make. Identify all the things that you're good at. It's time to step back into life. The only thing that's stopping you is fear, absolute fear. And you're afraid of rejection because you feel that you're not worthy. You're not worthy of other people's time and attention. Okay, so then if that's how you feel, then make it differently. How do you do that? You start picking up books. It's time to start learning. It's time to get interesting. It's time to expand what you've put a foundation on. Let's build the walls and put on a roof. Start expanding yourself. Read. Go take some classes. Learn something new. Go build birdhouses. Who cares? It's about doing something so that you feel good about you again. It's about building your self-esteem. Then get out there. Because the more isolated you become, the more you go down the rabbit hole. And that's the last thing you need, because it just keeps pulling. It's like you're pulling the wool up and over your eyes so you can't see. And you got to get outside, integrate. At least you've got good boundaries. That's good. It feels as if that your green energy, too, your green aura around you, which means you need to be outside more, eat green foods. You need to bring plants into your house. But get outside, start walking, look at this through the paper, find out what's going on around your area in terms of biking or bird watching or hiking. Get involved. Go to, you know, volunteer to help teenagers or something where they're outside, because being outside will start revitalizing you. Start getting the blood flowing back. You know, that's, think about when you were a kid. And what was fun was to go outside and escape and watch the butterflies and jump and skip and ride your bike and do those things. And you've totally walked away from that in your life.
Right.
Yeah, you're much more sedentary.
Right.
And
yeah,
you miss that.
Yeah, feeling of a child that every day is a new day is really lacking.
Yeah, every day is a brand new day. So if you could, I'm going to ask you right up front, what if you could do, what do you want to do? You want to go learn skydiving, or you want to go do scuba diving, or you want to go, you know, what would it be?
Well, actually, I'd like to learn how to meditate or something like that, more like release.
Okay.
I guess
then you can. There are a lot of places where you can do that, and yet I'm going to say one more thing, is I would truly invite you, meditation would be very good for you because it would help calm the demons that you got going on.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, though, is for you to get out and be physical. Be active. Get involved. Go do things. Because being meditative, again, you're going to be sitting on your floor or in your bed or something. It's about getting out there and being physical, being outside. Okay? That's really important. You've forgotten how good that feels. Do you have a bicycle?
Yeah, I do. I haven't used it for a while.
Yeah, hello. It's calling your name. It's saying,
yeah,
I'm lonely.
Yeah, it is spring, after all. I live in a third-floor apartment, so it's hard to get the bike out. But sure, I'll figure out a way.
Absolutely. No excuses. You got legs. You got hands. See, like you said, I don't take any excuses. It's like, let's go. Let's go. The challenge, of course, is carving out the time. However, you don't have a relationship. You don't have kids. I don't think you have pets. So, okay, what's stopping you?
I guess I should do it.
Don't tell me it's some fabulous television show, because that's not going to work for me either.
Yeah, I don't
want
to watch TV.
Oh, that's good.
The radio.
That's good, because you're learning. But think about all the things you want to be smarter on. Because this is, to me, the big thing about why we're here is, one, to be human. That, to me, is really big. And connect the head and the heart, which means that we follow our heart and listen to our intuition, so we're listening to our inner guidance. But at the same time, expanding our dendrites of our brain. We've got this amazing ability of this brain that we only use 8% of. That's scary. Imagine if you use 10%. Think what you could do at 10%. It's phenomenal. And that's only one-tenth of what the brain is capable. So the more you use it, the longer you keep it. And their studies have been proven over and over again that people who use their brains, even especially with the people that become elderly, if they do crossword puzzles and read, they stay mentally alert because the brain stops creating new dendrites. So you can build upon it by being proactive. So don't let it go stagnant now. Be physical. Start reading, get going, and then, you know, set yourself some big goals for yourself. Not so that they're insurmountable, because then you're going to stay at your apartment and call it a day. I'm talking about things where you're inspired. Think, who are your heroes? Follow their lead and start becoming involved. Because really, I see in your heart that's what you are missing. You're missing the human connection. It's really important. You're missing it. It doesn't feel like you're real connected to family. It just feels that you've become more and more in your own little world. And it's too bad you can't have pets where you live, because that would help. A dog would help, because it'd force you to get out.
Yeah. Yeah, too demanding. Even a cat, I heard, it'd be a bit much for me. But yeah, that's a good point. I feel like I'm moving towards that, though. One thing, you have to be able to laugh at all the things that you don't feel are right. So you can't be a perfectionist, totally.
No, absolutely not. And trust me, I understand that trait really well, because I was raised with perfection. I still demand perfection of myself. I totally get it. But what you got to do is let it go. I mean, so you have a mess here and there, or what you did is not 100%. I'll give you an example. I was talking about the lecture I just gave in Seattle, and I had to have enough food, so my blood sugar dropped, so my head was a little lightheaded. So my lecture was not up to what I call par, because in Portland I was down, Seattle I wasn't as clear. Got into it once my brain started working again. And so my first thought was, oh my God, Candy, you were really boring, because it's that perfectionist in there. However, I turned around and said, you know what? I had a group in there that were really interactive, and they had a good time, so knock it off already. You got to talk to yourself. You got to be willing to talk to yourself to change the picture. And so somebody out there that you're attracted to isn't perfect? Great. Have relationships that aren't perfect. Have friends that aren't perfect, every size, shape, and color. You know, every level of intelligence and creativity, because that's what makes life really rich. Nothing is perfect. In fact, if you think about it, even though nature is perfect in its own way, it's organized chaos. It's messy. It's awesome. So don't be so hard on yourself. You are worthy, okay? But the key is for you to start taking the steps so that you feel better about you, which means you have to take action. That's why I recommend reading, learning, so that when you talk to somebody, you're not talking about doorknobs. You know what I'm saying? You can come off in a conversation exciting. And because who do we like to be around? We like to be around interesting people. So make yourself interesting, and the only person who can do that is you. And I know you can. I know you can. I think meditation is a good idea, too. But I really highly invite you to be physical again. You know, because then you're doing something for yourself physically. And then you start feeling better about you, which raises your self-esteem. When self-esteem raises, self-confidence also becomes a part of the picture. And then you become more and more motivated, and you take more and more action.
Very reasonable.
Yeah, and you can do this. So, and I expect to hear from you. I expect an update.
Okay,
and you can do that by going onto my website, and then you can just click into my email from there, and you can give me, you know, a 2-week check-in, a 3-month check-in, whatever, and let me know what you're doing. Say hi, remember me from the radio, blah, blah, blah. This is what I'm doing now, because I will hold you accountable. That way you can't slip. Then you know you're not alone. Because if you think you're alone and that nobody cares, you don't do it. That's like for the person who called before, Diane. It's the same thing. Diane, if you're still listening, you write to me. You write to me. Hold you guys accountable. Keep moving forward. Because then you don't feel alone. It's great. It's a network of people. It's awesome. Think you can do that?
Yeah, I think I will. Definitely.
Okay. And it is. It's just CandiaSanders.com.
Okay.
So you can go on. After the show, you can go on, plug it in. So you've got it in there. You can find my email. It's like, okay, put a note on your calendar. Oh, yeah, I've got it. I've got to email her in 2 weeks or whatever it is and say, okay, this is what I've done. This is what I've done. This is what I've done. It's accountability. Okay? You can do it.
Okay, I'll do that.
Good. Well, I'm really glad you called. This is awesome. Like I said, you were good because I was 30 seconds more and it was au revoir. Hasta la pizza. So I thank you for listening to us. This is awesome. You know, I'm glad you tuned in to the Odyssey program tonight. And please stay tuned for future shows. And I will expect to hear from you on my email at some point.
Okay, I'll definitely do that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have a good night.
You too.
Thank you again for the Odyssey, you know, staying tuned with us here on Odyssey tonight. I don't know if I'll have any more phone calls. It is now after the hour, and I will do it. I'll put out the word one more time, 30 seconds in hasta la pizza. And again, thank you for staying tuned to us. This is great. I appreciate the fact that people hop online and give us a call. It's great. It makes my job really fun. It's a lot more fun talking to people than talking to myself. Trust me on that one. So, if not this week, please call us again here in the future. We're on every Monday night at 8 p.m. Pacific time. So give us a call next week. And again, stay tuned for other programming here on BBS Radio. And with those words, have a fabulous week, and I will be back on the air next week at 8:30, and Mike will be on, of course, at 8 o'clock with somebody fabulous and wonderful and some new wonderful topic that he always comes up with to discuss with everyone. So till then, have a great week, and good night.